The implosion of the Soviet Union ranks as the most extraordinary political event of the late 20th century. The effects of that momentous collapse will continue to play out through this century. A new documentary entitled The Collapse of the Soviet Union depicts the critical and little-known role of Estonia and the other Baltic states in the Soviet downfall. It makes an original contribution to our grasp of an historic moment that dramatically altered world affairs. My guests are Thomas Blanton, director of the National Security Archive at George Washington University, and Igor Grazin, co-producer of The Collapse of the Soviet Union. Gentlemen, welcome to Dialogue.
It's a pleasure to be here,
George. It's a pleasure to have you. This rather extraordinary documentary tells us a very dynamic story. I've had the privilege of watching it, and it's got everything in it. We have massive political protest, the passion of the people. We have strategies by individuals that reminded me of a chess match. They were so intricate and well-detailed. But it seems to me that at the very core of everything, we have a fact of history. The Ribbentrop-Molotov non-aggression pact just before World War II. So, gentlemen, I'd like to introduce our audience and ourselves to this conversation by showing a clip from that film and asking our first question. So, let's look at it.
The Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, signed in Moscow on the 23rd of August 1939, was a non-aggression treaty devised by Soviet Foreign Minister Molotov and Nazi Foreign Minister von Ribbentrop. But it also included a secret protocol. Under the terms of the pact, Stalin could occupy the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, and declare war on Finland. In return, Hitler was to have a free hand in Poland. A week later, on the 1st of September 1939, the German Wehrmacht invaded Poland, and the Second World War began.
Well, that's pretty striking stuff, and I think the film makes very good use of the historical background. Tom Blanton, let me address the first question to you. You won the George Polk Award some years ago, and the citation reads that you won it for piercing the self-serving veils of secrecy. How did those veils of secrecy serve the Soviet Union in keeping the secret protocols of this pact from the Baltic states and subjugating that region?
Basically, that secrecy was a core part of the Soviet myths about what is called the Great Patriotic War. And I was present in Moscow in January 1993 when the actual original of that agreement was put on display in an exhibit catalog case for the first time at the first opening of the Communist Archives. And an elderly fellow who had fought in the Great War, who had his old greatcoat on and he had medals across his chest, walks over to the catalog. He stood in line for 4 hours to see it. I mean, it's a mob in there. He looks down at it, and then he faints, literally faints. And as he's carried out, maybe you remember this television footage. It showed on Russian television. They asked him, why did you faint? He said, well, I knew about it. I had read about it. Yakovlev had announced it at the Supreme Soviet in 1989 under pressure from the Estonians and the Baltics. Right. But seeing it myself made it so real. It was such a shock because it undercut everything really the Soviet people had been told about the relationships with Hitler and the Soviet role in ultimately beating Hitler.
That's a terrific answer. I really appreciate the emotional of that anecdote. You have a comment on that, Igor?
Well, actually, it was kind of a not well-known secret in a certain way. Actually, even 2 or 3 days after that secret protocol was signed, it was published, its main content was published here in the United States and in many other countries, and generally Estonian diplomacy knew that. So in a certain way, it was, and I'd like to repeat the same idea, it was part of a Soviet ideological legend. It was not so much really, it was secret, nobody knew that. It said all the historians in the world knew. Question was to show and admit its existence, and right. It went to the core of Soviet empire.
But maintaining that Soviet historical legend, as you so nicely put it, was essential to the
yes.
Soviet regime in keeping the lid on.
Absolutely.
In the Baltic
particularly
states.
In the Baltics.
Yes. In the Baltic
yeah.
states.
Yes.
I want to continue on this vein because we opened with this wonderful historical clip. The documentary does a very fine job, in my opinion, of giving us a progression of incidents that lead up to the downfall of the Soviet Union that step by step, you know, may not amount to an extraordinary event in and of itself, but the link, the ties are very powerful. We see, for example, from 1987 onward, the rejection of, by Estonians of a proposed phosphate mining project on environmental grounds. And I think there's very strong evidence of continual economic discontent in the Baltic states and Estonia, particularly with the Soviet Union. But gentlemen, to me, the most striking moment, continuing on these Ribbentrop-Molotov line of thought, comes when there is the revelation of what this thing is all about very publicly. And I'd like to show you a clip right now that brings the what I call the chess match aspect of this to the fore. So if we can take a look at the second clip.
The Kremlin might have succeeded in hiding the truth, but for the dogged determination of committee member Endel Lippmaar. His detailed and incisive speeches, his encyclopedic knowledge of historical events, and the thorough research he carried out in the United States, at last pierced the armor of Soviet lies.
Ja siit ma tõin siis ära Saksamaalt pärit salaprotokolli Ameerika poolse koopia. Ja sellel koopial on ka siis kinnitustempel Ameerika Ühendriikide poolne, kus on siis peal nii copy from the National Archives in Washington. See avaldas head muljet sellepärast, et teise suurriigi dokumente võetakse tõsiselt. Ja see oli täiendav tõendus, et asi on tõsiselt võetav, sest need olid ilusti sõja üle elanud filmide tekstid kõige oma plätakatega siin.
Well, this, I think I have questions for both of you, and I, from the smiles, I think you have answers for me. Igor, first, and then Tom. Igor, you are, in addition to being co-producer of this film, you are a former parliamentarian, and therefore a colleague of Edward Lipsma. Tell us about the emotional impact of that moment, what all of that meant to you.
Okay. Endel Lippmaar, he's a unique man, and he's fighting his political fight about the environment till today and just today back in Estonia. By the way, he is microbiologist by education, but he has absolutely unique memory, and he's working material through really with all the details, etc., etc. Okay, about Endel Lippmaar's role. If Lippmaar has decided to do something, he always achieves it. And by the way, one of my personal last meetings with Gorbachev, it was tete-a-tete somewhere, he said, okay, I let Estonia go, but you will take Lippmaar with you.
That moment in that film is really my favorite moment, because I spend my professional life trying to open up documents
exactly
like this. And as a documents fetishist, I love seeing him hold up the American copy captured from the Germans during the end of World War II,
right,
to bring back to the Soviet Union to expose the lies. There's a wonderful, this is what we've been after after the end of the Cold War, is sort of raise the bar on openness in all these countries,
right,
breaking the veil of secrecy here at home, breaking it in Moscow, although it's been reimposed, unfortunately. But what was, I think, fascinating about the whole effort to really uncover the pact was it by picking this one key piece of the keystone, if you will, of the arch of the legend, the Soviet legend. For the Baltics, this was the core of their claims to independence and the core of the opinion of the international community that Soviet occupation of the Baltics was illegitimate from the beginning.
Yes, not perhaps I, as a lawyer, I simply add to the viewer what's the point here is. This is a paper that proves that Soviet Union prepared for the Second World War, initiated it to a very large extent, and in that preparation occupied three independent states. Let's keep in mind, very many countries lost their territories, people, etc., etc. Poland was cut off, and then some part of Germany, etc., etc. But only three states disappeared from the map of the world,
right,
completely. Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania.
Right.
And legend made it that it was voluntary communist revolution and they joined.
It was far from that.
But it was far from that.
And we have, this is the documentary proof of precise
yes,
that point.
Yes, exactly.
I also think, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, because I watched the film closely, but as a layperson, not as an historian or a scholar, or even as someone who had been there, But doesn't this occur just almost exactly 50 years, this revelation,
Absolutely.
After the original pact? Because it was 39 it was signed, it's 89 that we get this present, so to speak, that just blows the whole thing apart.
Yes, absolutely. Mm. And then, by the way, we are just now making a next documentary about these 50 years after it was signed and why it was kept this way.
Well, we look forward to that. Gentlemen, let me move us to the roots, what I call the roots of rebellion, why all this happened in the first place. I mentioned the phosphate episode, the rejection of the mining proposal from the Soviet Union. But, and I want both of you to contribute to this, what led to this kind of Estonian reaction to the Soviet Union, rejection of the Soviet Union? I have in mind myself the fact that the Estonians, as I said earlier, reclaimed independence, that they must have been historically displeased by the fact that it had been taken away from them. But what are the things sort of made all this happen?
I would argue that there was political space into which the Estonians and the other Baltics could move,
move. Created by what?
Created by variety. Created in part by Gorbachev. Igor and I, just before the cameras started rolling, talked about what would have happened if Andropov, the feared former KGB chief and butcher of Budapest, had lived instead of dying in 1983 and giving way ultimately to Gorbachev. If Andropov was around, fewer people in Eastern Europe would have been willing to go to the streets because Andropov didn't have compunctions about bringing in the tanks. Oh, Gorbachev did. So Gorbachev's sort of non-use of force opened space. The other dynamic, and it's very well, I think, illustrated in the film, is the space created by solidarity in Poland. Really by the other protests and dissent movements, both in the Baltics, but in the rest of the bloc, the Helsinki committees coming out of the Helsinki Final Act of 1975, Charter 77, the Czech lands in 1977, and then these huge uprising in Poland that ultimately involved 1 in 4, 1 in 5 Poles were members of Solidarity before martial law.
So you're saying, Tom, in a sense, the surrounding political climate, so to speak, was favorable for this to occur.
It opened space. Now, just the existence of space doesn't mean it can happen.
Yeah.
It takes really brave people who see some vision of the future and then go and push it. Right. Well, the Estonians certainly did.
As a participant and active participant of these events, I must say that, to be honest, there had been no generally designed master plan how we will become independent. It was just taking opportunities every day a little bit, little bit of risk. And as a pure scholar, formally, I should say it was a little bit Freudian situation, that every day you did a little bit more than yesterday. You are testing the limits and you are expecting KGB guy showing up or some repressions against you, etc. But you go every day looking for the limit, and there are no limits.
Exactly.
And then it becomes actually scary that there is no walls around you anymore.
But see, that's why this is
such... But you don't know.
You don't know.
That's
why this is such... I mean, again, as a layperson, this is such a human story. You say people pushing a bit. Ah, there's more space. We'll do this. We'll do that.
Exactly.
I asked at a big conference in Europe, co-sponsored by the Wilson Center's Cold War Project and the National Security Archive, we asked a whole series of the dissidents, at what moment did you expect the tanks to come in?
Right.
And one fellow, Vujak, who'd been the underground Solidarity leader, he said, well, I thought they were, you know, once Brezhnev died, I thought there was no chance they could bring in the tanks because they made the Poles do martial law. The Soviets were chicken to do it themselves.
Right.
So 1982, a Czech dissident said, no, we kept expecting the tanks as late as December 1989.
Gentlemen, this is a wonderful point now to introduce one of my favorite moments in which I think things got very creative and perhaps in an unanticipated way. I want to roll this clip right now because I think we'll see an example of just what we're talking about.
In May 1989, Gorbachev, committed to perestroika, had set up the Soviet Congress of People's Deputies, a first step towards genuine democracy and a chance for representatives of the republics to air their concerns and grievances in Moscow. Gorbachev told the Estonian delegates he would discuss anything except the abolition of socialism or the breakup of the Soviet Union. At that time, the 1st of June 1989, Estonian politicians were not yet permitted to speak officially about the independence of Estonia in the Kremlin. So this was their chance to raise the issue of the sovereignty of the Soviet Union over their country. and their aspiration for economic independence. This was the beginning of a complex and sometimes dangerous cat-and-mouse game. Juhan Aara was able to film the 1st of June meeting as an Estonian TV commentator because he was also a deputy and member of the Congress.
That little clip raises a lot of very important points. The original footage is one of the things I'd love for us to talk about. But first, isn't this an example of maybe more happening than you expected? You're right in that, Igor. You go in there expecting one thing, and I'm beginning to think maybe you're thinking more things are possible as that goes on.
Here the portion was, a portion of all this puzzle was the fact that officially, within the limits of then existing Soviet legality, Estonia rose two issues that are of extreme importance and were of extreme importance for Gorbachev himself as a Soviet, mm-hmm. not Estonian or nationalist leader. Number one, it was giving back economic control to the local municipalities, republics, and stuff like that, and undercut the overall power of Politburo, who was working, by the way, hard. Politburo worked very hard. Guys worked 20 hours per day, but they were stupid. That was their problem. Mm-hmm. And Gorbachev needed to put the power back, economic control, is number one. And on a second hand, he wanted also to raise the political activism, at least against the local party leaders. Mm-hmm. Officially, it was what Estonians were talking about. So Gorbachev's interest in this footage was we were pushing our agenda, but he was he wanted to learn the faces, to learn the names, to know the people who are doing the thing that he intended to do later.
That's a fascinating background.
And you can really see in that footage one of the reasons Gorbachev ultimately let the Soviet Union go, because he believed in his own power of persuasiveness. You see Gorbachev, the politician, shaking hands, joking. Yeah. He really does think if he just sat down with those obstinate balts that he could persuade them not to leave. He says to his own Politburo in some documents that we've gotten released that he doesn't believe the Baltics will actually secede because they'd be giving up access to Russian oil and gas and it'll hurt too much. Right. He misunderestimates, to use a phrase, nationalism, nationalism in the Baltics, and he overestimates his own power of persuasion as a politician.
By the way, to comment on this footage, I'd like to point at the little, you know, perhaps secondary detail, but still, you see the room where this meeting takes place. Mm-hmm. It is ordinary smoking room for the drivers of all these Kremlin limousines.
Oh, the chauffeurs.
Chauffeurs, yes. It is chauffeurs' smoking room, and there is just only benches and one TV where they can smoke and relax.
Well, that's what I love about history. It makes its own settings. I want to move us to more of this very fine film and footage. But one quick question, Tom. As an historian, what's the use of things like this documentary, this kind of footage? Do you find it useful in understanding what went on?
There's no substitute for it in many respects, because the challenge we have, I think, studying history is to ever get back to how it felt at the time. Distance gives us objectivity and more perspective and more comparative ability, but what we lose is the emotion, the atmospherics. We lose Igor's shaking Gorbachev's hands, and then you can see he feels conflicted about that. And he crosses his arms, and he's a little uptight about it.
Let me honor my own rule about quick comments. I was fascinated by that. The eye play, the body language.
Exactly.
One fellow there was a dissident. You saw how he acted. I mean, it's marvelous stuff. Here's another example in a very different way of marvelous stuff about the way people felt, because culture was a big part of this Estonian uprising as well. So let's take a look at one manifestation of that.
Of the Estonian Declaration of Sovereignty and the Singing Revolution, the national movement which followed, had an enormous impact on the Soviet Union, an impact that can be compared to the influence that the Polish Solidarity Movement had within the Warsaw Pact countries.
You know, we've had the Velvet Revolution, the Orange Revolution, but the Singing Revolution, this is a very cultural aspect of this. And what does it mean to an Estonian? Why is that such a powerful word?
Well, simply because it was one and the single unique, massive event in Estonia that had started in 1860s, that once in 4 years, usually it was leap year, that was arranged, and Tsarist regime allowed it, was this tradition of song festivals, this tradition that is now within the Book of Records of UNESCO and stuff like that.
Right.
So it was a place where the people were used to come under all regimes, including German occupation, whatever, singing was something that was very, very usual. Mm-hmm. So it simply took another twist. There was no, let's say, grassroots organization work needed, mm-hmm. like, let's say, in Orange Revolution in Ukraine, you go there. It was a place where Estonians come together. And on all that song festival ground, mm-hmm. then you understand how small the country is. You may have one-third of the whole population
right.
on one song festival ground.
It's an extraordinary dynamic because here, again, you're breaking the Soviet legend. The Soviet legend is that of the creation of the new Soviet man, the homogenized socialist of the future. And yet, Gorbachev sees his system doesn't work. He tries to fix it. To fix something, you got to face it. You got to face the problem. So he does glasnost to try to open up, to take a look at the problem. Mm-hmm. You open up a little bit, he finds underneath the new Soviet man are actually a bunch of old Estonian right, men and right, women and right. children. Because the persistence of cultural and historical memory was something Gorbachev never recognized. He never recognized the power of nationalism, the appeal of ethnicity, the role of the Catholic Church in Poland, for example, mm-hmm. which was key to the rise of Solidarity. Always, he never got it.
Well, he never got it. And Tom, are these ethnic, historical, cultural facts also powerful in linking what's going on in Estonia to the other Baltic states?
Absolutely.
Making it spread.
Yes, absolutely. And there's one more interesting thing, that since Lenin till Gorbachev, Gorbachev was the first guy who did not have any contact with nationalism at all, mm-hmm. because Andropov, Butcher of Hungary, right. Stalin, Georgian himself, Khrushchev, Ukrainian, mm-hmm. Not all these others, Brezhnev in Moldova, right. Gorbachev was only Russian. And that's it. So for him, it came as a surprise.
Well, this exactly. goes back to Tom's earlier point about opportunities created by individuals and historic yes. moments for things to happen. Space.
Yes.
In many ways.
Yes.
Gentlemen, I want to turn us to, and I want to watch the whole documentary over again, and viewers of this program are going to have a chance to do that right after our program. I'm happy to say they will see the full-length documentary. But one of my favorite moments comes at the very end, 1991. The Soviet Union has used force at this point in Latvia and Lithuania, I do
yes,
believe.
Yes.
But the handwriting's on the wall. And let's take a look at this clip and see what that handwriting tells us.
Estonian deputies went to the Kremlin for the last time in early September 1991. This time, they wanted the Soviet Union to recognize that Estonia had regained its independence. Estonian deputies joined Russian Democrats in supporting the motion to dissolve the Congress and to hand over power to a new ruling body, the State Council. The Estonian deputies lobbied hard and managed to get the Council to vote on the restoration of independence of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania as the first motion of its very first session. The State Council supported the restoration of the independence of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. The occupation that had lasted for half a century was over. The communist empire was falling apart.
Well, that speaks for itself in terms of its power, but I welcome your comments. Igor first.
Well, actually, this was a completion of the deals that were made earlier with Gorbachev, and it was definitely known that that this recognition of independence comes. But what was perhaps the most important moment, and you'll see it also in the film, is question of recognition. Mm. Let's say America had never recognized occupation, but America was a little bit hesitant also to go openly against Yeltsin, Gorbachev, which way they go. But the decisive moment was when Yeltsin actually said, enough is enough, Estonia is Estonia, Russia is Russia, and it's over. Mm. So we could, the actual reality of being already separated, let's say, to put it in the form of real divorce.
Right.
It was not separation anymore.
This is a divorce. Yeah.
Yes, mm-hmm. if mm-hmm. we use Windsorian royal terminology, separation was made into divorce.
Mm-hmm. Yeltsin, I think, gave a real tribute to the Estonians and the Baltics when he said they're marching ahead of us. But what happened was essentially those aspirations for independence in the Baltics helped give Yeltsin his political program and part of his leverage to take Russia independent. And that is what actually dissolved the Soviet Union. Because if your core becomes an independent federation, then what are you anymore?
Right.
So it is possible the Soviet Union could have continued the way Gorbachev talked about it to the Politburo as a federation that had more independent, different roles for different, even at one point to the Politburo says, well, even the Tsarists gave Finland and others different roles within the Tsarist empire.
Yes, but
it was when Yeltsin decided to use this idea that rose from the Baltics to be his lever to take out Gorbachev and become president in Moscow. That was the end of the empire.
To continue the metaphor, Tom, is it fair to say this created space for Yeltsin?
I may have given him the idea. He had a lot of space. I mean, at the point he had been purged from the Politburo and from the party,
right,
and yet he comes back at the time of the election to the Congress of Supreme Deputies in March of 1989 with an overwhelming victory in Moscow. And all of a sudden it becomes clear to him he's got the popular vote. Not really Gorbachev.
Well, gentlemen, I'm going to unfortunately have to call our conversation to a close on this very dramatic point, but I do appreciate, I think it's been absolutely fascinating to me and everyone watching. And as I said earlier, now everyone watching will have a chance to watch the documentary themselves. So thank you very much for that.
Thank
you,
George.
And thank you for this conversation.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guests today were Tom Blanton and Igor Grasnin. I'm George Liston-Cie, producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Sharana Harris. And our assistant producer is Keila Jackson. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.